This is Wayne Carroll for the SEC Historical Society, June 13th, 2005, and I'm interviewing Michael Mann.
I started at the SEC when I was in law school at Antioch School of Law. At the time, Stan Spork and then Ted Levine were my two securities laws professors, and Antioch required that you do a one-semester internship. I was in my second year of law school, and I went to work at the SEC in the Division of Enforcement, and at that time worked on a number of cases, one of which involving Occidental Petroleum. I worked on, and I was the last remaining staff person there at the time that the settlement discussions were going on, and as a result was given a summer job offer to continue to work on the case for Ted Levine. After that, I applied to the SEC for a job and started there full-time in October of 1981. My starting was in some ways coincidental with the start of the SEC's international program in many respects, because on October 5th, 1981, the day I started, the government of Kuwait announced a tender offer for all of the outstanding stock of a company called Santa Fe International. At the time, there were huge call option purchases that had been made just prior to the announcement, and the largest number of those call options had been purchased through Switzerland, through five of the largest Swiss banks. Like a lot of things at the SEC, there were many other options purchases that were being investigated, all of them in the United States, and the first order of business for everyone was to get a temporary restraining order to freeze the assets in the United States. And so on October 20th, the SEC went into federal court and sought a temporary restraining order freezing, suing certain unknown purchasers of call options for the common stock of Santa Fe International and freezing the accounts in the United States.
Michael, can I ask you to set the stage for us? How were international matters dealt with administratively, internally at the SEC as you began your career there?
Well, at that time, enforcement was probably the most active in dealing with international issues. There were not that many foreign issuers in the United States. The internationalization of the American markets was really taking place in terms of trading. The large international universal banks were not near the participants, and certainly did not have the foothold in the United States that they have today. And so it was really dealt with on a much more ad hoc basis, and dealt with ad hoc dealing with enforcement actions. So here, there was a huge challenge to the SEC, and in March of that year, there had been another case brought involving a takeover of a company by Seagram's called St. Joe Minerals. Then these two cases were running along in sort of a parallel way. After the SEC brought its injunctive action, about 2 weeks later, Judge Milton Pollack in the Southern District of New York heard in the St. Joe case a motion to compel discovery. In other words, the SEC had sued frozen assets at a small Italian Swiss bank called Banca Svizzera Italiana, and they had sought to discover who the customers' identities were. It was the fact that BSI had an account at 60 Broad Street or 60 Wall Street, I'm not sure which, and the court heard the motion to compel on the grounds that there was control from the United States and therefore the name should be turned over. Judge Pollack heard the SEC's motion, which was argued by a guy named Bob Blackburn from the New York Regional Office at the time, and ruled from the bench that it would be a travesty of justice to allow someone to trade in the American markets and then not comply with American requirements to turn over information, and ordered the bank to turn over the name. He said that he would stay his order for a period of days But afterwards, if the order was not complied with, he would fine the bank $50,000 a day.
And just for the listeners, this was before the MOU with Switzerland.
This was well before the Memorandum of Understanding with Switzerland. And really, the reason why these two cases are so important is Banca del Svizzera Italiana was a small, more of a marginal player in Switzerland. It was, however, that precedent before Judge Pollack that I think set a tremor through the Swiss banking establishment, where in the Santa Fe case, the largest Swiss banks were involved. Credit Suisse, Swiss Bank Corporation, Union Bank of Switzerland, not to mention Drexel Burnham Lambert, Swiss branch, and Citibank. Mm-hmm. So the power of the court's decision was anticipated after the court ruled. And I think at that point, there was a recognition first that Switzerland did not want to be regarded as an outlier with respect to dealing with matters like this. They wanted to be a larger player in the capital markets. And these banks did not want to see their access affected. And then secondly, it was clear that a U.S. court could well rule against them. So there was risk both on the business side and on just the case side. And what happened, which I think is unique even in the negotiation of MOUs, is the Swiss came forward and said, we'd like to try to work something out. Mm. And from that began negotiations on the SEC side with the Swiss authorities. And it was an odd configuration of negotiators because on the United States side, there was the SEC and the Department of Justice also participated. And on the Swiss side, there was the Swiss government in their foreign affairs ministry. There was also the Swiss Department of Justice. And then there was the Swiss Bankers Commission, which is a private association of bankers, but is the basically has a treaty among the banks that they enforce for cooperation.
So this you mentioned this was an initiative from the Swiss side in certain respects. How did they approach the SEC, or whom did they approach?
Well, my recollection is not all that clear still on the initial approach. At the time, I was a staff attorney in the Division of Enforcement, and what happened after the case was brought was everyone else who had been working on the case moved on to other things. Mm-hmm. Switzerland, I think, was not viewed as something that was going to be easily done. People had, you know, other things to get on with, mm-hmm. and so I was left working on this matter with a trial attorney named Bob Romano, but principally I was left working on how are we going to get this information out of Switzerland.
Yeah.
And so when the Swiss approached the staff, I believe the approach was to John Fetters, who at the time was the director of enforcement, and I was pulled in as the staff person to work conceptually on this to try to figure out how it would work. From the SEC side, the two main people working on it were John Fetters, who was the head of enforcement, and Ed Greeney, who at that time was the general counsel. The approach initially, I think, came from the banks themselves. And what they did was they came forward and said, we don't have a particular mechanism to recommend from a negotiation standpoint. We think what you should do is make a request under the 1973 treaty between Switzerland and the United States on mutual assistance in criminal matters. Mm-hmm. At that time, the odd thing was insider trading was not illegal in most of Europe, and certainly not in Switzerland.
Yeah.
And so we met with the Swiss Department of Justice and the U.S. Department of Justice in the first instance to figure out, could we make a treaty request?
Yeah.
And we determined to do it. But the reason we determined to do it was because the Swiss came forward and said, we will come up with something better. We will come up with something new, and that's when the real discussions began.
Just to stick with the St. Joe's case for a minute, this case is described in the 1987 SEC report on the internationalization of securities markets,
yes,
which is also on the Society's website. According to the outline, in that case, step one was a voluntary waiver was sought of the information holders. That didn't get the SEC anywhere. And there was resort to the MLAT, but not with the desired effect, apparently.
Well, the request under the MLAT was done long after they got the name of the person.
Okay.
It was for additional information. What happened was, after the court ruled, miraculously, Giuseppe Tome, who was the beneficiary of the trades and who was a confidant of the Bronfmans and Seagrams, voluntarily agreed to have his name come forward. Nobody knows why he so agreed, but one can imagine that there was an enormous amount of pressure on him, not the least of which was that his profits were going to pay the fines of the bank if he didn't come forward. So he came forward. The court's order was never enforced, and additional information was sought. If you want to talk about what happened under our treaty requests, was in the first instance the treaty requests were made, and the Swiss Supreme Court ruled against the SEC, mm-hmm. saying that we had not alleged with enough particularity that the person trading had been a tippee. What the court found was that while insider trading wasn't illegal, stealing a corporate secret was. And if you could allege with particularity that the trading was done by a tippee, then they would grant assistance. In fact, the SEC, in that period of time we had been investigating, and were able to allege that there was a tippee in the case, and that that's how the information had been transmitted. And ultimately, in about 1984, the SEC learned the names of the unknown purchasers, mm-hmm. and filed suit against them, and ultimately settled the case, getting the ill-gotten gains. But I guess the point here was, the Santa Fe case was viewed by the Swiss as, you know, starting this, but they couldn't solve it with a new agreement. And so there was enormous amount of pressure to try to make the old agreement work.
Yeah.
What was negotiated ultimately was what's been referred to as Memorandum of Understanding and Convention 16.
Mm-hmm.
The Memorandum of Understanding was an agreement between the United States of America and Switzerland on how the two countries would conduct themselves in terms of dealing with insider trading. Convention 16 was a private agreement among the bankers that if certain circumstances were met, the banks would have in their hands waivers of Swiss bank secrecy that would allow them to comply with the request that would be made through intergovernmental channels. And both of these agreements sort of fit together to allow the SEC to be able to get access to evidence.
And would that be an agreement or a waiver on an ad hoc basis, or would that be something as a part of a customer bank relationship in Switzerland?
It was part of the customer bank relationship. There were a couple of things that I think are unique about it and are really important from the SEC's perspective and from a historical perspective. The Memorandum of Understanding is incredibly narrow. It just deals with insider trading. It really just deals with insider trading in mergers. It only deals with very short time periods before the events involved. It has thresholds in it. It was a very narrowly negotiated agreement. At the time the judgment was made, that's where the problems were.
Yeah.
There was an enormous amount of pressure, including from me as the staff person working on it, to say, we're not getting everything we want.
Yeah.
And the judgment was that it was better to get less than everything, but to create something to see how it would work, to try to change things, than it was to negotiate for years and years and years and not really have a breakthrough. And so the judgment was made, and there are a number of pieces of that negotiation where things broke down because, you know, there was a lot of pushing for more, and it was a recognition that there was, as Jean Zwalin, who was the lead negotiator, or the Swiss said, at one point he said, you know, there's a lacuna in our law that we can't cover this. And so we said, let's put that in the agreement. And so there's this paragraph. It's the only international agreement I'm aware of that uses the word lacuna. And it was sort of the joke among all the negotiators that, you know, they, obviously this was no lacuna. This was a gaping hole. But it was characterized that way with a view towards the fact that Switzerland was going to make insider trading illegal. And that's the commitment that was made, that they would make it illegal and that the treaty would always work, mm-hmm. and that there would be no issue going forward on this. Now, as it turned out, it took many years to make insider trading illegal. The MOU was used a variety of times to get customer information. But what was really striking about it was a change in terms of negotiating. It was a change in terms of looking at the outside world, where the SEC really was able to lead the negotiation with the support of Justice and the State Department and work out something that was, and this is the other important point, a memorandum of understanding. It wasn't a treaty. It was a statement of intent between two parties. And there again, the United States generally negotiates treaties. Treaties are enforceable in international law. Memoranda of understanding are not enforceable. They're just statements of intent. The judgment that was made at the time, which I think was the right judgment and really set the tone for the way the SEC would proceed, was if it doesn't work fast, if you don't have a meeting of the minds on both sides, it's just not going to work. Markets need to move quickly. They need to resolve things. And therefore, whether it was a treaty or a statement of intent made no difference, because mm-hmm. no one was going to go off and spend their career negotiating at The Hague or litigating at The Hague for enforceability. It was really a matter where both countries' stake in this was their capital markets.
Yeah. You mentioned that there were attempts to get more in the negotiations. Did that more entail trying to have a general coverage of what would be a violation of U.S. security laws?
Yes.
If they would, that would violate the counterpart under Swiss law?
Well, no. The whole idea was to get away from this concept of dual criminality, which is the sort of the touchstone in most civil jurisdictions for providing assistance, civil law jurisdictions for providing assistance. There was a recognition that at that time Switzerland had no securities laws whatsoever.
Yeah.
They had business laws. Their markets were just tiny. And they, you know, they hadn't anything that they have today in place. This is, you know, 25 years ago. And so there was never going to be dual criminality. It had to be a recognition that where one country's law was violated, and this, we were talking in a civil context here. It was not a criminal violation. The SEC was not pursuing a criminal violation. Ultimately, what the Swiss Supreme Court said in Santa Fe was that they would regard the SEC as a criminal authority because U.S. laws could be enforced criminally. And so it was a huge leap that was made by the Swiss Supreme Court in saying the SEC was in fact a criminal authority for these purposes. This actually did not necessarily help the SEC in other jurisdictions, because in other jurisdictions where it was arguing it was civil, it made it more difficult.
I see. You mentioned that the issue of the SEC having to go indirectly to enforce criminal aspects of the securities laws, did that lead to any discussion about possibly seeking authority for the SEC for direct criminal authority?
No, the SEC never sought direct criminal authority. I mean, there was an enormous amount of discussion with the Department of Justice, because there was an Office of International Affairs at the Department of Justice that was run under a Deputy Assistant Attorney General named Mark Richard. And he had established and led, actually, the negotiation of the Swiss Treaty, which was the first mutual legal assistance treaty ever negotiated. And Justice was very jealous of its authority under these treaties and did not, and really wanted to control its relationships. And the SEC was developing new relationships, and it wasn't entirely clear how that would work. It wasn't until 1989 that we really, or actually probably 87, 88, where we began talking about getting legislation to allow the SEC to do mutual legal assistance. But that really is sort of a later chapter in all this. Probably the next chapter you want to move from, unless you want to talk more about the MOU, I'd move to is when we came back from that negotiation, one of the things that John Fetters and I, the chief counsel of the SEC, a guy named Fred Wade, began talking about was that Judge Pollack's decision basically said, if you play in the U.S. markets, you play by U.S. rules. Mm-hmm. And that maybe the best thing for the SEC to do would be to codify that principle in a rule. And we codified it in a phrase called waiver by conduct. And in 1982, shortly after the treaty, the MOU was negotiated, we published an article in the Pennsylvania Law Journal on waiver by conduct, which was about the idea that if foreign companies come into the United States, they should be required to waive mm-hmm. as a matter of access to the U.S. markets. This proposal was not just written up as a law review article, but it was written up as a concept release. Mm-hmm. Initially, it was written as a rule proposal, and John Fetters took it to the chairman of the SEC, and there was a lot of discussion at the SEC, and ultimately, the commission was unsure what to do, and so it was not put out as a rule proposal, but rather as a concept release. Mm-hmm. When it was put out, they received, I think, about 85 or 86 comments from foreign governments, from U.S. government agencies, from individuals, markets, and the like. I think of the 86 comments, 85 were negative, including one from the Department of Treasury that said it would balkanize the American markets to pass such a rule. Hmm. So it was resoundingly defeated. The only people that thought it might be a good idea were the CFTC, which was, from the SEC's perspective, not the kind of endorsement it was hoping for. But what was really interesting about waiver by conduct, that I would say it was probably the most important transitional point for the SEC's international program, because everyone who responded, all the countries who responded, said, why don't you negotiate with us? We'll work this out. This is a matter of international law. If people are in our jurisdiction and they're doing something wrong in your country, we should be able to find a way to work it out. And so the SEC, the response from John Fetters and the SEC was, okay, well, let's see whether we can work it out. And that began then the first series of negotiations. John departed, actually, before any of the negotiations really began in earnest. The next really important negotiation was with Canada.
I have two questions before we move on. You discussed a bit the reaction of some of the other government regulators and agencies to the Pennsylvania Law Journal article.
It was actually to the SEC published this as a rule proposal.
When you were looking at different models for information sharing, did you look at any of the treaties in existence or information sharing agreements, such as the ones that the Antitrust Division had, as possible ways forward to the SEC?
Well, I guess two things. One, I don't think the Antitrust Division really had anything at that point that I recall. The Antitrust Division had just gone through the whole Westinghouse, Rio Tinto Zinc fight in the UK, and where they'd been essentially blocked from getting information. The second thing was, at that time, notwithstanding the fact that this agreement had been worked out with Switzerland, it was felt strongly at the SEC that unilateral means were the most appropriate way to go. And if people had unilaterally come into the U.S. market, that they should not be able to hide behind the cloak of foreign secrecy law or foreign law, for that matter, and that it would be much more appropriate to get the waivers up front. What the MOU with Switzerland stood for was these banks were getting waivers from their customers under certain circumstances, And so why go through international judicial means? Why go on a government-to-government basis? Why have a negotiation? This was something that could be done by rule. And so really, expediency was what people were looking at. And the concern was that at that point, the U.S. market was just exploding. The options markets, listed options, were really becoming popular. We were in the middle of a takeover boom. There were enormous number of insider trading cases being brought, and you could see the volume coming into the U.S. market from abroad. And the fear of not being able to react quickly enough, not really knowing how to do it beyond that, and also the court had said in an unequivocal way that there was jurisdiction. So it was not, I mean, the choice was just not to go down that path. Yeah. Ultimately, the decision was that that was the appropriate way to go, because at the end of the day, if you want, notwithstanding any victory you'd have in court, you'd still have appeals and there'd still be delay. And so, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be all that expedient.
Before we move on to Canada, the Katz case gave the first opportunity to test the MOU. Could you briefly describe how things worked, the first trial run?
I don't think Katz was the first case that we used it for, but it was the first case where it was used and the information led to information being provided where a case was brought.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, that's really, in terms of, one of the things that I think, you know, is probably least understood is there are lots of suspicious things that you investigate that you don't bring cases on.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think the Swiss learned from the Memorandum of Understanding was that the SEC would often ask for information because of suspicious circumstances and then drop the matter. Katz was a case where the information actually, you know, was the ultimate information, mm-hmm. and therefore the case could be brought.
And moving on to Canada and other MOUs?
What happened in the hiatus between August of 82 and, I guess, January of 86, when the Canadian MOU was signed, was in between there was a Memorandum of Understanding signed with Brazil,
mm-hmm.
Which was very similar to the Canadian MOU. But what happened was the recognition that the SEC actually did not have the power to provide the assistance they were asking for from a foreign authority. The SEC had the ability, under its inspection powers, to require a broker-dealer to turn over information.
Mm-hmm.
But if you went to the SEC, a foreign government went to the SEC and said, listen, we need some information from a bank, or we need some information from a telephone company, the securities laws say, you know, under Section 21, it says the SEC has the power to enforce this title. So it's domestic. It has to be a violation of U.S. law. And so it was somewhat odd that as we were sitting there demanding foreign authorities cooperate with us, that there was a recognition that we, in fact, did not have the power to cooperate with them. That indeed, and this was a discussion that, you know, there was a lot of difference of opinion on, we probably could argue in most cases, because of the breadth of the U.S. law, that anything that occurred in the United States could be regarded as a violation of U.S. law, but it wasn't really what was intended.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we sat down to negotiate, first with the Brazilians, though it was somewhat more of a general discussion, and then with the Canadians, whose laws are really structured like the American laws, notwithstanding the fact they're provinces, there was a recognition that we had to change the law.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did was we decided that, you know, in the first instance, we should signal each other's cooperative intent. This was just a statement of intent, after all. We should negotiate the framework for what we would want if we could change the law. And then we would go to our legislatures and ask them to change the law. So rather than, you know, doing it the way you do with a treaty, which is you negotiate the treaty and then the treaty is ratified, we made this decision that, in fact, the better course would be to have a memorandum of understanding that created a framework, and then get the unilateral power, the organic power under the securities laws, to implement the memorandum of understanding. And so that was what the negotiation was really about. And if you look in the memorandum of understanding, at the very beginning it says, neither authority has the power to actually implement this thing, but we're both committed to go out and get it.
Mm-hmm.
And from there is, you know, a very broad statement of coverage covering essentially the whole of the federal securities laws, a very broad statement of the manner in which cooperation will be granted in terms of gathering documentary evidence and testimonial evidence, confidentiality understandings. Again, there were confidentiality understandings that went beyond what the SEC could in fact provide, because the Freedom of Information Act applies very broadly to information which was provided. This is a big problem for foreign authorities.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not even all that focused on at the time of the first negotiation, but it was something that came up a little bit later. And I'll get to that, I guess, in a second. But so the memorandum was signed by the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
And was put in place in 86. At that point, we sat down and started to figure out how should we modify the federal securities laws. And there were a number of people who I worked with at the SEC. At that point, I was essentially negotiating these agreements, working with Gary Lynch, who was the director of enforcement. But I was leading that effort within the Division of Enforcement. An Office of International Legal Assistance had been set up,
mm-hmm.
Which I was the chief of at that time. And we were working with the General Counsel's Office. There was a board of worked with Tom Wiesenberg and Phil Parker in the General Counsel's Office and tried to develop the legislative proposal. And what we came up with was, I think, quite an elegant approach, which was Section 21 of the Exchange Act said, as I said before, that you can assist, that you can investigate violations of this title. What we did was we broke 21 into A and B. A was for the SEC, investigate any violation of this title, and B was investigate any matters that would be a violation of this title if they had occurred in the United States, essentially implementing the Memorandum of Understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So we came up with this proposal, and at that time it was just beginning that a group of enforcement officials were meeting internationally, and it was taking place in London, outside of London, at a place called Wilton Park, mm-hmm. Wisdom House. And we went to that first meeting, Gary Lynch, I think Rick Ketchum, and I. And we said, listen, we were talking about cooperation and memorandum of understanding, and we were really trying to get all the countries to consider signing MOUs and also consider the broadest assistance possible. And we raised this as an idea. And there was a lot of discussion about it. But one of the things people said was, if you're going to change this, our biggest concern with you is the Freedom of Information Act. So would you consider seeking a legislative change there? And we came back and had a discussion and decided to put forward a proposal on the Freedom of Information Act as well, that provided that where confidential information was obtained from a foreign securities authority, it would be not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. And so that proposal was put together, and there were two other pieces of that legislation, one which grew out of a case that the SEC had earlier that year, where a foreigner had been trading in the U.S. market, and we had provided assistance to a foreign government, to essentially to prosecute the foreigner, and then the man wanted to move to the United States to set up and work in the United States as a broker. There was no means for barring him from being a broker because he hadn't violated U.S. law. And so it highlighted that in an era of international cooperation, there was going to need to be the ability to bar someone where they'd been found guilty of a foreign securities law violation. And so both the Advisors Act and the Exchange Act were also proposed to be amended. And then the fourth piece was to amend the Exchange Act, Section 24 of the Exchange Act, which says all the information gathered by the SEC is confidential. We were obviously going to be providing this to a foreign authority, and so we needed authority to provide information. So all of that was wrapped up in a package, and in June of 1988, it was sent to the Hill by then David Ruder, who was the chairman of the SEC. Went up in June, and one piece of it, the international assistance piece, passed as far as part of the ITSFIR legislation, mm-hmm. and it was just lumped in there, and it was passed in November of 1988. So very, very fast. There was a hearing that was held in June. There was a report that was issued by the Senate Banking Commission, and it was while the legislation, the whole piece of legislation, did not go through at that time, it was put in conference. And so the SEC, with almost no fanfare whatsoever, got this incredibly powerful piece of authority in less than 5 months. Hmm.
To round out this part of the discussion, what were the concerns of the foreign counterparts in relation to FOIA? Was it fear of subsequent civil litigation based upon securities law violations, or can you describe
it was a matter of, in their jurisdictions, their investigative records were completely confidential, mm-hmm. and they couldn't be in a position where a person that they investigated in their country was in a better position than someone that they provided assistance for, that mm-hmm. they needed to have their laws complied with as well. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing if the person had violated the law, then the SEC could use the information any way it wanted. But where the information just ended up residing in the SEC's files with no action taken, mm-hmm. they viewed it as fundamentally unfair that person would be subject to the freedom of information. So that's where that came out.
Okay. What was going on the capital raising side during this period? We've talked a lot about what was going on the enforcement side. What kind of efforts were going on in your office and other offices to facilitate foreign private issuers?
Well, at this time, it's still a little bit early mm-hmm. for what I would regard as the push that the SEC made. The 144A, Linda Quinn, had developed 144A, which really became the engine of what I think Linda would have called the try it, you'll like it approach to accessing the U.S. capital markets. And that occurred during this time period in the 80s. So there were a number of privatizations that were going on during this period as well. The British Telecom privatization, the British Airways privatization were probably the first two of the largest privatizations. And so governments were increasingly interacting with the SEC during this time period. And indeed, at this time period, sort of coincident with the seeking of the legislation, the SEC negotiated a memorandum of understanding with the UK Department of Trade and Industry. The people who were leading that effort were, this is actually before 88, this is in 86, were also the people that were leading the effort to pass securities laws in the United Kingdom and to do the privatizations that were taking place under Thatcher at the time. The MOU that was negotiated in 86 was a very narrow market MOU. It didn't involve any of the things the legislation ultimately involved. But it started a conversation with the DTI, which was then had the resident power over companies, and with the two sort of civil servant leaders within it, a man named Brian Hilton and another man named Jonathan Rickford, who was, Hilton was the head of the, on the business side of the DTI. Rickford was the solicitor, the senior lawyer at the DTI. And that started those discussions. And, you know, quite frankly, a lot of it was focused on how to make rules that would make it easier for privatizations to occur and offerings in the United States.
Mm-hmm. As this bilateral track continued parallel to efforts at the international level, what determined who you were negotiating with or talking with, which countries?
Well, there was very much a take all comers on in a way. I think that we looked at the markets where we had the biggest involvement, number one, and secondly, the plan from the very beginning, and the reason why we negotiated first with Canada, was the Canadian system was the closest to the American system. Mm-hmm. The best, their commitment to fairness, their commitment to markets was very similar. We regarded it as potentially the best deal that could be negotiated. And from a strategic point of view, you always want to negotiate the best deal first.
Mm-hmm.
The UK was obviously the largest other market.
Mm-hmm.
We needed to have a relationship with them. They were playing a key role. It was a narrower agreement because they frankly didn't even, Big Bang had not really occurred yet in the UK. And so they were anticipating their market expanding, and we wanted to go from there.
Mm-hmm.
The next set of negotiations after those two were with the Netherlands and with France. And those two agreements were the first two continental European agreements.
Mm-hmm.
The Netherlands, we had developed through the Wilton Park meetings a very close relationship with, and they had a very robust view of what the law should be and how cooperation should work, and had said very early on they wanted to make a broad-based commitment. France had been playing a leading role internationally in trying to internationalize the IOSCO, the International Organization of Securities Commissions,
mm-hmm.
and so they were also a natural party to be negotiating with. We negotiated those MOUs in 1988, and signed them. They were the first MOUs signed by Richard Breeden when he became chairman of the SEC. We took a first trip to Europe in December of 1989.
You mentioned that some countries at this time didn't have securities laws per se and or didn't have an exact security regulator. So you maybe had to negotiate with a ministry or a department or a subdivision. Did that complicate matters at all?
It's a good question. I mean, it didn't complicate matters in terms of the interpersonal relationships. It did complicate them in terms of the SEC's relationship with the Department of State and the Department of Justice, because everyone is jealous of, in a good way, jealous of their relationships. The Netherlands, for example, was represented by the Ministry of Finance. There was no STE as it exists today. They didn't have a securities law yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was signed by the Minister of Finance. It was also ratified as a treaty in the Netherlands,
mm-hmm.
which, so on the United States side, it was being regarded as an MOU, and on the Dutch side, it was being regarded as a treaty, which doesn't really work in international affairs. And ultimately, what happened was we found a way and got permission through the Department of State and got authority from the president to have it signed as an executive agreement. And the chairman signed it as an executive agreement. It was witnessed by the ambassador. But it was a complex thing, both in terms of who led the negotiation, who said what was correct and accepted it before it was actually signed, and it required a multitude of approvals, many of which we were at the SEC, after all, enforcement lawyers. We were not diplomats. We were trying to negotiate enforcement agreements. We were trying to be very practical. And it was not always the easiest relationship on this side of the border. On the other side, they made it work very well. And at the end of the day, everyone worked well together. But, you know, just even going back to the legislation that was sought, the Department of Justice recognized, and the State Department recognized, that once the SEC had this legislation to be able to sign MOUs, that they'd be basically to the side. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of side letters that were written between the SEC and the Department of Justice, and there were letters written to the Senate at the time in terms of how these agreements would work to ensure that the international affairs of the United States weren't somehow impaired by this rogue independent agency that now had very broad powers. Hmm. Just one sort of aside to all this, no other agency in the United States ever had this broad power that we came up with. Mm-hmm. And one question that has always occurred to us is, but for the insider trading scandals of the 80s, would anybody have been able to have gotten such authority? The Antitrust Division, when Ann Bingaman was the head of the Antitrust Division, tried and went, and I actually went and testified in favor of their authority, which was modeled after the SEC's. By the time everyone got through with it, it was a shadow of what the SEC had, and much more limited. There was much less discretion left in the government. The SEC's legislation does not require a memorandum of understanding to cooperate. It just requires a commitment to cooperate. Whereas the Justice Department, which arguably should have much broader authority, has much narrower authority for antitrust matters. Hmm.
Moving sort of internally to the SEC, you mentioned that there was an Office of International Legal Assistance within the Enforcement Division. Did these developments lead to a call for an umbrella Office of International Affairs? How did that come about?
Well, each of the offices had people who dealt with international matters. There still is to this day an office in both market regulation and corporation finance and risk management that does that. And everyone worked together on a cooperative basis, and it worked pretty well. There was good collaboration. There was a lot of camaraderie. The other division directors and Gary Lynch and I had all started at the SEC and worked together for many years. So there was a very good cooperative approach that was taken. When Richard Breeden came as chairman in 1989, shortly after we came back from signing these two memoranda of understanding, he called me in his office and he said, "It's ridiculous that our international affairs are run out of our enforcement division. There are all these other initiatives. There's a need for real coordination. I'm going to set up an Office of International Affairs," and asked me to be the first head of it. At the time, it was not met with extraordinary enthusiasm from the other division directors. And it led to what is probably the only undocumented memorandum of understanding that was negotiated between myself, market regulation, Rick Ketchum, who was the head of market regulation, and Linda Quinn, who was the head of corporation finance. And basically, both Linda and Rick, I think, were not in favor of this, viewed this as the most interesting part of what was going on at the SEC, in which their offices were going to play critical roles, and were in favor of seeing this role diminished. Mm-hmm. And Richard said to me, "So go work it out." And so we sat down and basically came to an understanding of how we would work together. And it was, in hindsight, I think we all laughed about it, because I would say none of the fears that this office would take over and start dictating international policy ever came to pass. It was always collegially run. And in fact, the efforts to negotiate were so much more bolstered by the fact that when a foreign country would come in to sit with us, they'd be sitting with a senior enforcement official, a senior international official, somebody who knew the markets better than anyone else, mm-hmm. and someone who knew the corporate side better than anyone else, that it really played to the SEC's greatest strengths. And under Richard's chairmanship, we not only negotiated many, many memoranda of understanding, but we worked out understandings with countries to facilitate offerings in the United States, to use the memorandum of understanding to overcome what sometimes were information imbalances, mm-hmm. to be more flexible on various rules, but to accommodate them by having greater oversight through the memorandum of understanding, and also to work with countries that had emerging markets that were, at this time also, you have to remember, the Berlin Wall was falling. There were all these Eastern European countries that wanted to have markets. The Latin American markets were just growing up. And what you basically had as a result of this negotiation was you created a team of people who worked together all over the world to try to both build markets but also enhance the reputation of the American market. Mm-hmm. So it ended in a very interesting way, but that's how it actually began.
And the agreements that you reached about the internal workings of the office and within the other divisions, was any of that written down or more informal?
No, there was actually a writing that was created. That mm-hmm. was, I think each of us had a copy of it. Mm-hmm. But in essence, I haven't looked at it in years, what it really provided for was that everyone was in charge of their own space mm-hmm. and would work together to enhance things. Mm-hmm. So the Office of International Affairs would be focused on international cooperation mm-hmm. and enforcement, and would facilitate the other offices' efforts.
Sort of a coordinating body.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And what was the birth date of the office? Was it December?
December 89? Of 89. Mm-hmm. December of 89.
And just a year later, you negotiated the first MOU with an Eastern European securities regulator. Is that correct? With
Hungary? Yeah, that was a very different thing than our previous MOUs. The focus of the U.S. government with the fall of the Berlin Wall was on trying to help these markets emerge and develop. And there was no real concern in the United States that there was going to be a lot of insider trading out of Hungary. The concern was that as this market developed, both as a competitive matter, but also as a matter of good governance, that it would be better to have the Hungarians looking to the United States for technical assistance than looking to Europe mm-hmm. or somewhere else. That mm-hmm. our systems were different, and that there would be great advantage to support and develop those markets so that they would align with the American market, not just, in terms of cooperation, but in terms of the whole legal scheme being developed. And that's what it was a short memorandum of understanding in which the SEC agreed to provide technical assistance, and there was obviously a paragraph on cooperation in the event of enforcement matters. But what it really was about was enhancing that Hungarian market, which was the first market to open after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Mm-hmm. The SEC had, under Richard Breeden, who I think had, enormous vision in this area, built an emerging markets profile where agreements were reached with foreign countries to assist in the development of their markets, but also we established an International Institute on Securities Markets Development, which was taught by the senior staff of the SEC in the headquarters office, and where we would invite two people from every emerging market to come. And it was really an extraordinary event because you had often, and to this day it's run annually, 70 or 80 countries would send two delegates. And to it each year. And what it provided, I once had the head of a foreign stock exchange came to me and said, you know, it's incredibly anti-competitive that you run this international institute. I said to him, why is it anti-competitive? He said, well, these people come, train them, and then they run their markets the way you run your market. They look to your law, they understand exactly how things work, and when we come to them and say we would like to have an alliance, they would say you need to be more like the Americans. So it was, but in fact, it was not just a matter of, you know, convincing people how we ran our markets, but it created a global understanding that was extraordinary. It helped people connect with each other. Mm-hmm. And often the best teachers of how you deal with emerging markets problems are the emerging markets. Mm-hmm. It gave the SEC insight into those markets that was extraordinary. And it gave us entree into those markets in terms of going in when there were offerings and talking about problems that existed. I remember well that one time I went to Asia with Chairman Levitt, and at that time we were talking about, you know, how vital is this institute? And every country we went to, we would meet in the chairman's office of that institute.
Imagine your baby in a chop shop. Sees profit, why do you pay higher insurance rates? All state's broad team is on it, so you pay less.
Up on this wall, next
crime
to
doesn't pay.
The authority granted
neither
by its governing.
That's all state, Dan. Are you in?
And we walked out, and I remember Arthur turning to me and saying, you know, the power of this is greater than one could ever have imagined. It really did change, I think, the way the SEC was perceived also. The SEC was never much liked internationally. It was viewed as, you know, the guy with the big stick.
Yeah.
And today, to this day, I think still is viewed as someone with a very large stick.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a way of, you know, change by having technical assistance, but also having an international affairs office that negotiated. It was a way to have a conversation and to try to work things through. And I think, you know, if you look at, whether you look at the offering of Daimler Chrysler, at that time Daimler Benz, which was, you know, the first German offering in the United States, there were enormous number of changes, facilities that had to be accomplished in order for that offering to take place, and flexibility by the SEC, but it was a very successful offering. Or if you look at any of the other international offerings, it really, I think, was in many respects the SEC's greatest hour,
mm-hmm.
to be able to do what, you know, had always been a concern. There had always been pressure on the SEC to relax its regulation. And the exchange was, in exchange for not relaxing its regulation, it was accommodating foreign differences. And the result was GAAP financials, you know, remained the gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
The American market view was viewed as the good housekeeping seal. And at the same time, we went from having basically a domestic market with a lot of Canadian participation to being an internationalized market today with over 1,000 foreign issuers.
Do you think what you learned in the 80s on the enforcement side about obstacles under foreign law, did that assist in the more international capital markets program initiatives?
I think, sensitizing the
SEC about the obstacles and possible accommodation?
I don't want to go too far in that direction, because I think it was understanding where there, not so much obstacles, but issues that needed to be resolved, and finding ways to do it, which didn't necessarily mean just doing it the most straightforward way.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, I don't think the SEC really compromised on very much in those negotiations. But what it did was it found ways through the problems, either by going to foreign courts and getting their assistance, going to the foreign governments and getting them to change their laws, and developing understanding where there was a level of trust that things would work.
Mm-hmm. I've heard things about an SEC-type office in Warsaw, Poland.
Yes.
Could you describe?
There was one. The Polish, the chairman of the Polish SEC had been actually one of the first participants in the SEC's international institute named Les Paga. And Paga had been, Lesois Paga, he had been an intellectual. He'd been in jail during the prior regime, and he was the leading proponent for setting up the securities market in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to the SEC and he asked, would we send somebody to Poland for a year? And Bob Strahota, who was an attorney at that time in the general counsel's office, of enormous experience. He'd started at the SEC early in his career, gone out and become a partner in a law firm, and then come back to the SEC for the end of his career. Bob volunteered to go and live in Poland and help them develop their markets.
Was the AID involved in any of these technical assistance programs?
The AID funded the office in Poland and paid for much of the technical assistance, including often paying for the participants to come to the International Institute. It was one of the debates we had with AID, actually, that it will show you in a sense how international, how oddly international this was AID wanted to have the Institute translated. And so they wanted to have a bank of translators like the UN in the back of the room. And we said, listen, this isn't going to work. The translators don't know anything about markets.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, English really is the language of business, and we would rather struggle with people's English and have this all be one language so they will talk to each other and insist that they talk to each other than to have translators. Well, we won that fight except for one language, Russian. They said to us, listen, you're never going to get the Russians to come because they just don't have the facility. And what we thought was they meant the people from Russia. Well, so I walked into the Institute the first day with the Russian translators there, and I looked at the number of heads that had headphones on. Well, Russia had been the second language of every Eastern European country. And so there were, many of the delegates, including the Vietnamese delegate, who had been trained at Moscow University.
Mm-hmm.
So it perhaps an irrelevant anecdote, but it showed in a way both how much the world was changing when you sat down with this Vietnamese delegate and said to him, why are you listening to the Russian? He said, well, my Russian is much better than my English. I received my economics degree in Moscow. And in fact, he was there to learn about capitalism. Mm-hmm. So it was fascinating.
Was there any pushback from, the European community at that time, concerned that the SEC programs may hinder their own integration efforts within the EC?
Well, it's a good question, though I would actually spin it a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
The SEC was trying to figure out how it was going to deal with Europe, and we were somewhat concerned because everyone was interpreting European directives differently,
mm-hmm.
and it made negotiating with these 13 countries very, very difficult. And at the time, Leon Britton was the minister who had the portfolio for securities. I actually went and met with him and with his staff and said, we would really like to find a way to make this go more easily. And what we had in the back of our mind was, if the European countries, which jealously guarded their jurisdiction over securities regulation, saw us going to Europe and possibly having an agreement with Europe and losing their jurisdiction, they might be easier to negotiate with.
Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, if we could set something with Europe that then could be emulated by the other countries, we'd be better off with those negotiations. And we were very upfront about it, both with the individual countries and with the Europeans, and Britain really got this point. And so we negotiated a very short communique, which went on the SEC hosted the IASCO annual meeting in October of 1991.
Michael, we left off when the tape ran out with the SEC hosting the IOSCO meeting in 1991.
Yep.
If you could pick up.
Oh, so at that meeting, we had planned to sign a whole host of memoranda of understanding. And at that, we signed one in Sweden, we signed one with the UK that was very broad-based, and we also signed this communique with the European Union. Sir Leon came and gave a speech, and it was really heralded as the possibility for new types of cooperation. In fact, it was the only agreement that the SEC ever negotiated during my tenure with the EU. And what it really did was it put back to the Europeans the question of how were they going to deal with the European Union. I'd like to take credit, though I'm sure it's not correct, but shortly after that agreement was signed, the European Securities Commissions organized themselves into a coordinating body that... Union, but coincidentally, it did occur at about the same time.
Mm-hmm. As we moved into the 90s, in the meantime, the GATS agreement is being negotiated, including how it would affect financial services, banking, securities. Did that have much impact on what was going on in securities regulation?
Well, the SEC, there came a point in time where we realized that this negotiation called the Uruguay Round was ongoing, and that it covered our area, and nobody had asked. And so we actually went to the Treasury Department, who at that time was leading the negotiation. We said, we think we should have a seat at the table. And they said, you're not part of the U.S. government. And there was a, complicated discussion that culminated in the SEC participating in the negotiations, obviously not at the table per se, because we were represented by the executive, but in terms of setting the parameters for what would be acceptable. There was a lot of concern because a lot of what the SEC does is to deny national treatment potentially for investor protection issues. And so what the SEC developed was a prudential carve-out that was included into that agreement and into subsequent agreements like NAFTA. Actually, NAFTA was before this was signed. And to have very clear language about the role of the regulator. And so the SEC participated very actively in trade negotiations. And during the Clinton administration, had a very, very close working relationship, not just on trade issues, but sort of across the board, dealing with the Japan relationship. There were a whole series of negotiations with Japan about access of American securities firms. And the SEC played, I think, an important role in working with the American firms and with the Treasury to develop proposals that ultimately were put into place.
Do you recall any of the concerns that were discussed from an SEC perspective as the GATS was being negotiated?
Well, the main concern was the ability to regulate. There would not, that if you did this on a strict national treatment basis, that you would, you didn't want to end up with, the biggest fear was GAAP.
Yeah.
The Germans have their own GAAP. If they come to the United States, they would say, we have to have a second GAAP. Americans don't need to. Why should they? And the reason was because accounting is prudential. It's not a rule in terms of denying access, though it had that effect. So it was very important that those types of rules, stock exchange rules, stock exchanges in the United States require residency. Well, there's an anti there in the trade agreement. Residency is not, a basis for denying access. Mm-hmm. But there's a prudential reason for it. And so making sure that the unique interaction between securities laws, and the self-regulatory organizations, and the way the markets operate was something that was not going to be necessarily accommodated by an agreement that was worried about how, you know, parts were sent from one country or to another, mm-hmm. or the requirements for, you know, the tensile strength of screws or something like that.
Yeah.
And so this was not like sending motion pictures or just protecting copyright. There were other interactions where the judgments needed to still reside within what was not an executive agency. And so that's really what was feared, mm-hmm. and I think it was appropriately accommodated.
Mm-hmm. Was the prudential carve-out the goal or the focus of the SEC the entire time? I believe other areas compiled lists of potential violations of MFN or NT under GATS, sort of a list-it-or-lose-it approach. Was that ever an issue with the SEC, or did they say we want to preserve the status quo from a regulatory perspective?
Well, I think there was engagement across the board,
mm-hmm.
but because most of these projects that were developed were things where, you know, there was discussion. From the SEC's perspective, I think the focus was the prudential carve-out.
Mm-hmm. Now, you finished up your career at the SEC in 1996?
Correct.
Is that correct? How had the Office of International Affairs developed, you know, over the past 7 years?
Well, it was an office of, I think, about 22 or 23 people that was really focused not just on enforcement, but mm-hmm. on market issues, emerging market issues. Mm-hmm. Cross-border cooperation in a more general way.
Mm-hmm. Compared to how many in 1989?
Well, in 1989, there was me.
Okay.
So, no, that's not right. In 1989, there was the Office of International Legal Assistance, which at that time, I think, had two people besides myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it grew, you know, substantially. But its function grew.
Mm-hmm.
It was really responsible for implementing the IOSCO relationship. In 1989, IOSCO was really a fledgling organization. Mm-hmm. It had been started in the 80s by the SEC as the Inter-American Organization of mm-hmm. Securities Associations and related affiliated organizations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was really an effort by the Inter-American Development Bank, and AID, to do something in this hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
It was only broadened to include other members outside of the Americas in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the proposal of the creation of something called the Technical Committee,
mm-hmm.
which was the G10 of the markets. It really didn't come into play until about 1988.
Mm-hmm.
The SEC's commitment to that really grew in 1990 when Breeden became the chairman of the Technical Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And so the work of the office in terms of implementing the work of the Technical Committee, representing the commission in various meetings and working with the other divisions on their subject matter areas in terms of developing agreements and protocols became much greater at that time.
Mm-hmm. Before we wrap up the oral history, is there anything that you'd like to add, anything that stands out in particular in your tenure at the SEC?
No, it was an incredible time. I think the SEC was so well positioned. The markets were just in such an interesting time and place that it's just extraordinary when you look back and you think about how much was changed and the idea that, you know, it's, if you look up on the wall there, standing at the Great Wall of China with Richard Breeden, and we spent 2 weeks traveling around China meeting the heads of governments of all of these countries,
mm-hmm.
because at the time there was nothing more important than markets. And so, you know, whether it was in China or Japan or throughout Europe, we were received by the most important leaders, not just of business and industry, but of government,
mm-hmm.
to talk about markets. And there was interest to me having discussions that were not political discussions, but were detailed discussions. So when I look back at it, it's extraordinary memories. And, I just hope my counterparts at the SEC continue to have some exciting times.
Michael Mann, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks a lot.